chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest my dab in the middle of it. Rest my dab in the middle. We are rest my dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness, we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Got a lot going this week. This war in the Ukraine is seeming to be at loggerheads. And I just hope that neither side comes out ahead and they can try to negotiate a ceasefire and get this thing concluded one way or another. But anyway, we've got Greg Reese here starting off the program this evening. Here we go with Greg Reese.
Zelensky recently described Putin's denazification of Ukraine as laughable, and the brainwashed flock of the mainstream media certainly must agree. They have been told that Nazis wave the American flag and vote Republican, and the brainwashed flock always believe what they are told. But those of us still cleaving to our sanity remember that Nazis were members of Hitler's National Socialist Party from the 1930s and 40s. And not only were there thousands of Nazis in Western Ukraine back then, it is still a big part of their national pride. Nazi war criminal Stepan Bandera is a national hero, and there are actual Nazi organizations still thriving in Ukraine, including the Azov Regiment, which is now a part of Ukraine's armed forces. The Nazification of Ukraine is well documented and easily verified, as is the Nazification of America. During the 1930s, there were many notable Americans who supported the Nazis, such as Prescott Bush, Henry Ford, and Fred Koch. Banks such as J.P. Morgan and Chase Manhattan. Companies such as General Motors, Standard Oil, Shell, and IBM. Major General Smedley Butler of the U.S. Marines was asked by these powerful entities to help them install National Socialism in the United States.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government.
And when that plan failed, war broke out in Europe with the support of the banks and these American corporate entities. After World War II, only about a dozen were brought to justice at the Nuremberg trials. The Catholic Church and the Vatican helped thousands of Nazis evade capture via the rat lines, which brought them mostly to South America, where they built an entire town in Argentina. In Operation Paperclip, the United States secretly absorbed thousands of Nazis into the U.S. government, where they led the NASA space program and helped pioneer the military-industrial complex as well as Big Pharma. Many believe that being a Nazi is synonymous with being anti-Jewish, which may have been true in 1930s Germany, but it's complicated. Many high-ranking Nazis themselves, including Adolf Hitler, were Ashkenazi Jews, who can be traced back to the notorious Khazars, who mysteriously mass-converted to Judaism about 1,300 years ago in the region now known as Ukraine. Ashkenazi Jews ran the political Zionist movement in Germany, and for several years, the Zionists were the only political party allowed to operate inside Germany by the Nazis. Both the Zionists and the Nazis wanted their own ethnically pure state, and for years before their final solution, the Nazis helped the Zionists in their efforts to establish the State of Israel within Palestine. It was far more complicated than mere racial hatred. Nazism can best be described as fascism, and fascism is godlessness. The word Nazi is a made-up slur, but the word fascist can be clearly defined. It stems from the Latin word fasces, which is a bundle of sticks banded together to form a deadly weapon, an old-school meme that represents the deadly power of an organized mob, a gang. When men lack a personal relationship with God, they inevitably band together out of fear. Submitting to the strong man for a small taste of dominance, they become just another beast in the jungle. And today, we can clearly see this fascist mentality in all of these godless groups. The woke, the Satanists, the transhumanists, and the genocidal mass murderers of the Great Reset are all merging together into one giant fasces. Godless men and women banded together out of fear. Fascists serving the strong man. Spiritually speaking, these are the weakest among us. And so far, we are allowing them to destroy everything. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
The Ukraine is seething with corruption over the years. And, the president's son was over there with Burisma and all. I mean, it's just a god-awful mess what's going on over there. Anyway, this is a quick DW report, an overall view of what's going on right now. Here we go with DW report.
Well, there's been surprise at the apparent struggle Russian forces have faced since launching their attacks on Ukraine. Despite having superior firepower and troop numbers, Moscow has not so far had the success anticipated. But despite their difference in size, both militaries are suffering losses.
From air, land, and sea, Russia had been proudly showing off its military might for months. And it was no secret that it was far superior to Ukraine's. Before the war started, Ukraine's armed forces were at around 500,000, but Russia's were almost three times that at more than 1.3 million. While Ukraine had around 2,500 tanks, Russia had nearly 12,500, almost five times its neighbours. Ukraine's total aircraft strength, including warplanes and attack helicopters, stood at 318. Russia's was more than 4,000. But a month after the war began, these figures have probably changed dramatically, with losses on both sides. The Russian Navy has continued to play a crucial role in the Kremlin's war efforts. Caliber cruise missiles are integral to the Navy's ground strike capabilities. It's believed one was used to hit this government building in the city of Kharkiv at the beginning of March. Russian Iskander short-range ballistic missiles have also been used in Kharkiv and other Ukrainian cities. And Moscow has been accused of using cluster bombs on residential areas, which would constitute a war crime. The Kremlin has also claimed it's fired hypersonic missiles like these at targets in Ukraine, although this has not been independently verified. No one knows how much further Russia will go in its assault on Ukraine, nor how long Ukraine can withstand attacks like these.
Well, for more perspective, let's bring in former British military officer Frank Ledwidge. He teaches strategy at the University of Portsmouth. In your opinion, who's winning this war right now?
Russia aren't achieving their objectives by any means. In fact, they've not taken any of their major targets just yet. Ukrainians are holding them. If you want an answer, I would suggest, Ben, that the answer is probably the Ukrainians are winning at this point. The Russians have now culminated, is the military term, means at the first phase, they've gone as far as they can. They've been stopped by the Ukrainians and they don't have sufficient supplies and equipment to go any further. But your reporter there mentioned Russia having 2 million soldiers and or X number of tanks. It's entirely right. but they've deployed a far smaller number than that, and they won't be able to get access to the rest for quite some time.
Their supply lines and communications are down. Generals have been killed. Where does that leave the Russian military, considering its very top-down approach?
Yeah, and that issue of being top-down dirigiste is an important one. We, or many of us anyway, those people who hadn't actually worked with the Ukraine armed forces underestimated them. And one of the advantages they have over the Russians is the conceptual element of war. That's the element that looks at how you fight. And since 2014, when they were defeated by Russia, Ukraine's taken a very different approach. They've been trained by Western forces in something called mission command, Auftragstaktik, as German military theory calls it. That means you trust your subordinates. And as you pointed out there, Ben, the Russians don't take that view. It's a top-down command approach, and that means your generals, if things aren't working out, they'll be going to the front and they'll be taking casualties. Of course, there's other reasons for that, mainly Western assisted, but certainly excellent Ukrainian intelligence, which is able to target these high-value targets. And the result is, and the result of all these factors, is that essentially Russian forces in most fronts are, if not in disarray, they're very much halted.
But, Frank, none of that will make much of a difference if nuclear weapons come into play. How real is this threat that we're hearing from Moscow?
It's a threat. For decades, the issue of nuclear weapons within Russian military doctrine has been treated as simply a step forward, not the kind of extreme step change that we, perhaps in the West, would regard it. That doesn't mean they're imminent. I would categorize what's going on now as a little bit of saber rattling. Russia quite understands that the deployment of such weapons, even in demonstration, would be a very real step change in the war and would almost certainly trigger NATO involvement and consequent defeat on the ground.
Would you say the same for chemical and biological weapons?
Well, that's where matters shift a little. My own view is that chemical weapons and biological weapons, whilst in themselves simply weapons that kill like any other, should be treated as a red line. We have retreated time and time again over the last decade, not only in Syria, but in Crimea and other places, from the Russians with various red lines that weren't complied with. And this should be treated that way. The risk here is, though, that the deployment of chemical weapons would be used as a false flag by the Russian armed forces in order to excuse other forms of escalation.
Frank, can you give us some hope as far as the people of Ukraine go? What could turn the tide for a Ukrainian victory in this war?
Well, one of the first things we can do is stop telling everyone what we're doing. It's up to the West, it's up to NATO, it's up to individual countries what they do to help Ukraine. All this agonizing about whether they should give fighters or this or that piece of equipment should stop. NATO countries should give what it is they want to give and not keep telling everybody about it and debating about it. Second thing, assure the security of the Baltic states. So that provides a backstop. As for the Ukrainians themselves, what we can do is continue supplying them with the best weapons, release the bureaucratic shackles on handing over some ready-made pieces of equipment. So, for example, some of the pieces of equipment in the British or American arsenals that will require various permissions to hand over. Those shackles should be released. And finally, NATO should start issuing red lines and complying with them.
Former British military officer Frank Lewidge, thank you very much for coming on the show today. Appreciate it.
You get all kinds of opinions and predictions about the outcome of this war in the Ukraine. Here we go with Fox, the Fox Friends in the morning. Weekend Friends, and they're interviewing some Green Berets. Here's what the Green Berets had to say about their angle on it. And they've been over there. We've been over there training since 2014 or 2015, many of the Ukrainian special forces. But here are some real firsthand views from some Green Berets. One of them is the Congressional Medal of Honor winner. Here we go next.
All right, for reaction, let's now bring in former Army Staff Sergeant and Medal of Honor recipient David Bellavia and retired Green Beret and leader of Task Force Pineapple, Scott Mann. Gentlemen both, thanks so much for being here. Great day to have your expertise. David, let me start with you. When you look at what Vladimir Putin is signaling as far as limiting to the eastern part of the country, your reaction to militarily where this is at and what it might tell you about an end state?
desperation? Are you going to do the best you can to put out the messaging that you have to put out right now? Because, again, the Russian people and these family members are, your blue star parents are becoming gold star parents in Russia right now. How do you explain this to leadership? You've got generals that are being killed right next to E5 NCOs, situations that are completely come up. Look, we saw the pictures of the T-72 tanks getting blown up. We're seeing T-90 tanks getting blown up right now. I saw an image of a torsion bar that was ripped out of the side of a tank. That means not only are you hitting those tanks hard, you're hitting them in close proximity. If you're allowing the infantry to walk up, the enemy walk up to your armored assets and blow them out like that, this is bad. So you got to unpack it somehow, and the soft landing is we're going to go to phase two. Phase three is waving white flags and running back home.
And Scott, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to various special military units in the United States of America, not much often on the one where you serve, the Green Berets, but they played a critical role in what we're seeing take place in Ukraine. Tell us a little bit about the role that not just Green Berets play at large in U.S. military conflicts or averted military conflicts, but right here in Ukraine.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, you're right. There has been a lot of focus on the Delta Force-style raids and strikes that we've seen over the last 20 years, and it's sorely needed. But what a lot of people don't know is Green Berets have actually been operating in Europe since 1952. They came out of the OSS Jedburgh teams who helped resistance there. They've been helping resistance forces literally for decades, and they've been working with Eastern European forces, to include Ukraine, for like the last 10 years. And what you see is not only are they building these capabilities that are on display that David just talked about, they're also building relationships. They've built relationships, and you build those relationships when risk is low, and then you leverage them when risk is high, and you're seeing that play out right now. It's not as sexy as the surgical strikes, but I think it's the number one way that we're going to be able to blunt Russia and China going forward in places like, I don't know, Afghanistan.
I want to ask you, David, about the Army lowering standards for soldiers. It's something that really concerns me. I mean, I just read an article now about height and weight requirements being lowered. Also, you know, just in terms of discipline, hairstyles. Now you can have two-tone nail polish, by the way. What does this do to our military? And how dangerous is it that these things are happening as we're seeing conflicts arising all over the globe and problems that seem to be expanding?
Look, you know, every generation, it becomes almost, you know, we look at the generation that came, you know, after us, and we always think complacency, lazy, why are we changing the standards? Rachel, the reality is that we've got a lot of young, patriotic, and earnest kids joining the military today, but they're soft, and they're fat, and they're sloppy like the rest of America, unfortunately, has become. And the Army has inherited that. And so we're dealing with a lot of push that are coming from, you know, society trying to change and become more woke. But I want you to remember the Russians about a year ago showed us how tough their propaganda army commercials were. And they're pretty intimidating. And the Russian army showing you exactly what it's capable of doing. They're a joke. They're getting folded up like chairs right now in Ukraine. So you know what? Whatever standards you want to change our nail polish, we will open the eyes of Iran and Russia and anyone that wants to challenge us on the battlefield, and then quickly close it with well-directed 556.
Following up on that, if you wouldn't mind, and I'll put this to you, Scott, on the Russian military, we never know what can be verified and exactly what is true, but there are reports of some of these Russian generals or Russian higher-ups, you know, dealing with essentially mutiny. Mm-hmm. Was it two different Russian?
Potentially two, but at least one that was run over by his own unit.
Right, run over by his own unit. What does that tell you? David was talking about a little bit earlier the morale and the ability of the Russian military. I mean, that's got to be somewhat of a watermark, I would assume, even for the Russian military.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell exactly what's true and what's not. And Ukraine certainly enjoys the information advantage, whatever, you know, is getting put out there, really having an impact on social media. It's astounding. And I think we're seeing a paradigm shift in how information warfare is conducted. We should really be paying attention to that. But to your other point about morale and David's point about standards, I mean, if, you know, Tom Brady, I'm in Tampa, Tom Brady's coming back to the Bucs. Everybody's super excited. If he followed that statement with, you know, kind of a rough season. I kind of overate, so I'm going to need a little different standard to come back and be the quarterback. I mean, he'd be laughed out of Tampa. But yet, if an older soldier, you know, if we, you know, we're looking at giving them a different standard to go to combat. I mean, this is our blood and treasure, our sons and daughters. It's ridiculous, and it does affect morale. And we have to think about those things as citizens and for oversight.
I read some of your point of view that you sent in before this topic today, Scott, and you pointed out that back when men, there were certain jobs that men and women did differently, different standards made sense. But if you're asking people to do the same task, then they better be held to the same standard, which makes a lot of sense to me. David, I want to get back to what's happening in Ukraine a little bit now in the American response. You've seen what Joe Biden has been saying over the last couple of days, what he said about U.S. troops potentially going to Ukraine, or we'll respond in kind with a chemical attack, or we never really tried to deter to begin with. Now he's about to give what the White House is billing a major address. When you think about our enemies around the world, not just in Russia, but in China and elsewhere, what are they reading from an American president abroad right now?
Yeah, I mean, this entire conflict is just screaming for American leadership. You hear it from our allies in NATO. I mean, listen, we don't want to know what Vladimir Putin's going to do when his back is against the wall, how this gets extended, how this further puts Ukrainian men, women, and children in harm's way as a desperate Putin decides to act out. But I think the real fear is, what is America going to do? Do we have a plan? What is mutually assured destruction? What are we prepared to do? What does a red line look like? We saw what a red line looked like in Syria a few years back and how little amount of effort it took for the American military to focus on breaking the back of the caliphate. Does this administration have a red line? And it's confusing, it's schizophrenic, and it's causing irreparable harm right now to the image that NATO has to actually implement its will across the globe.
Scott, I'm not a military expert, obviously. I'm a military brat, but I don't have the experience that you and David and Pete have. But all I can do is look at the last thing that happened, which was our exit from Afghanistan. And I just saw today in Poland, as the president arrived with the same team that got us out of Afghanistan in such a despicable way, I'm nervous.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to point that out. And I'd like to point out also that, you know, I think it's great that there's tacit support to the resistance in Ukraine, but there's also a resistance in Afghanistan. There has been. Vice President Saleh never left the country, even when Ghani did. He went to Panjshir and he fought. They're still fighting. There are thousands and thousands of Afghan commandos, special forces, still resisting. I mean, America used to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We were able to deal with multiple threats, certainly with unconventional warfare and working with partners. And we just abandoned the Afghan people. And that is going to come back to haunt us in so many ways. And I really hope that we can, you know, shift our focus also to that land that you just talked about, because right now there are unspeakable losses happening there. And that's a moral injury that's going to walk home with us and follow us forever.
Now, there's famine right now. There's children being sold.
Unprecedented.
It's just an unmitigated disaster, humanitarian disaster that we've left. And you're right, we're not talking
about. And Scott, the people your Green Berets trained are the ones that have stayed and they have fought and they're still fighting, to your point. And a lot of the people trained in Ukraine, those special operators trained by Green Berets, are the ones leading the fight against Russians as well. So we have the ability to train capacity, which you do, if we back it up properly. David Bellavia, Scott Mann, two guys that have always backed it up. We really appreciate your insight this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Great conversation.
Thank you.
Boy, and I'll tell you what, the Green Berets are good. They're our best. Anyway, Christy Lee does some tremendous reporting. Okay, Christy Lee Television, ChristyLee.tv. But anyway, here she comes up with a report. Now, this is not proof, absolute proof, and there is conjecture in this. So I'm prefacing this clip to mean that I don't think we have absolute proof, and that, you know, that this was, pay for play, you know. But anyway, here's what Christy Lee had to do with interview with the Dr. Alexander. Here we go next.
And at that point, I still wasn't sure, and I thought it was a friend of mine screwing me over, because I was writing so heavily against them, and I was taking apart the science and the data on the vaccines. particularly the data the New York Times had dropped about 18 to 49-year-olds on the third booster that Pfizer hit. The New York Times said, here's the data that, and then I was, and I recently wrote about the tranche that just got dropped where there were 1,223 deaths and 100,000 adverse events, 1,290 special adverse events. It was catastrophic. So, and I'm writing about this all the time. So I said, well, why would they ask me to, that'd be the last people. And then I told them no. I said, no, I wouldn't be interested in that because first of all, if you read what I'm writing, and I'm talking this person seriously, and I ended the conversation right there. So I basically, I would say I put the phone down. So I remember
I want to review. So this, when did you get this phone call? About when did you get this phone call?
About, so if we're in, maybe around 3.5-4 months ago.
Okay, 3.5-4 months ago, you get a phone call. You don't know how they had your cell phone number. It was a person identifying themselves as from Pfizer. You were a little bit like, what's going on? Because it's not like I've been putting out some favorable information.
I got a call again.
Okay.
And it's in that separate call, second call. You know, the person said, what they were alluding to is, would you consider a position in pharmaceutical if you got a salary of $50,000 a month? I told the person, if you read what I'm writing and you understand my positions, I worked in the Trump administration, and I broke with them on the vaccines. I am totally against the vaccines, particularly in children. So they have no way that I could work in a situation like that, because if I worked for an organization, I would have to toe your line and support what you are doing. You cannot employ me. So in other words, if I took any kind of income, if I worked for a company where my views were adverse to what they're doing, they're going to fire me after a day. So if the implication is that I take a position and I no longer say what I'm saying and write what I'm saying, mm-hmm. knowing that the risk that there is to me, I do understand the risk, not just to me. I understand the risk that we all take. They have many places that Dr. Malone, Dr. McCullough, when we go to speak, we have to have security with us because of what the media does. The media ramps up the people in society.
Yeah.
And they have crazy people in society.
Oh, for sure.
So we have to be very conscious of what we see and where we go. So anyway, and then the person said, well, if you were offered, if you got $1 million to come to an organization with a $50,000 a month salary, what would you think of something like that? Of course, when somebody tells you something like that in the position that I was in, you know, like at first, again, my mind went back to this. These people had to be fooling around with me because they couldn't be serious. First of all, why would you? But I also knew that I'm punishing Pfizer, if you read how I write, because I don't write my opinion. I share the science. I actually am putting on paper what the data is showing in Scotland, in UK, etc. The harms of this vaccine.
Bring in the data and the damages. Yes.
Right. So I am punishing them. So in my mind, I told myself this could be a real discussion, and I said, you know, basically I said, I don't think that this is a situation that I could function in, and that I would not be interested in this. In fact, there's no situation where based on my beliefs today, on what I've seen in the data, if you put this in writing, if you made me, if somebody gave me a job offer, if Moderna, if AstraZeneca, if Pfizer put a job offer on paper to me with what you're discussing, I wouldn't take the job, because that would mean that I would then have to go against everything that I've said, and I would actually now have to start fighting Dr. Malone and Dr. McCullough and Dr. Risch, these people who I think are the real heroes, not even me. So I said no, and that's it. And I've heard nothing more, and I decided.
So do you feel like you were offered hush money then? Was it a bribe?
Listen, that's a heavy word to use.
So we can't use bribe, we can't use hush money, but essentially you had a dangle of fruit in the form of a job offer with money, but the condition was that you stop bringing the data and documents that were unfavorable to Pfizer.
Well, let me ask you a question. If it were you, and I had that conversation with you, would that not be here in France? Would that not be the expectation? Why would they hire me?
Right.
I am one of the harshest.
As if, like, the top news network offered me a news anchor job right now after they see that I've been trashing mainstream news and network news.
You will not be able to.
No, I would know it's conditional.
Okay, that would be an unspoken, even if they did not put it in writing to you, that would be an unspoken understanding. And if you did it, you'd be out. So they have things that I don't need to tell you, that you would understand what it is that we mean. It's ridiculous to think that Pfizer would offer me a job today that would not mean that I would have to embrace their ideology and their vaccines and their everything. So that's, in my mind, that's what it is.
We're going to put up next a Tucker Carlson interview and, you could say, opinion, commentary about what a woman is. This Judge Jackson would not answer that question this week when quizzed by senators about what a woman was. I mean, this country is just getting ridiculous, isn't it, when you can't answer those kinds of questions. But here we go with Tucker Carlson. And then at the end, he talks about the gentleman that has taken over Twitter, I believe, and about his view about our free speech rights. He doesn't think we have any. But here we go with Tucker Carlson.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. In the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday, Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee asked Joe Biden's Supreme Court nominee, Ketanji Jackson, what should have been the easiest question ever posed. Can you define what a woman is? Now imagine, put yourself in her position and imagine how relieved Jackson must have been when she heard that question. Here she stayed up all night trying to memorize obscure case law from the 19th century and court precedent. And when she finally gets to the hearing room, all the Republicans want is a recap of day one of ninth grade biology. What's a woman? For a world-famous scholar like Ketanji Jackson, that should have been effortless. Talk about slow and steady right down the plate. A woman, Jackson might have said, looking incredulous. That's simple. A woman is a human being with two X chromosomes. Ask any geneticist. It's detectable in a blood test. But if you're still confused by what a woman is, you can ask a doctor. Women have wider pelvises and different bone structures from men, not to mention very different genitalia. It's usually pretty obvious they're women just by looking at them. Women are built differently because their bodies are designed to do different things. Nature is real. Women menstruate. Women give birth and then breastfeed. Men do not do these things because they can't. Not a single man in all human history has ever had his period or delivered a baby. And I know this, Senator, because I'm a woman myself. In fact, that's why I'm here. Joe Biden nominated me to the Supreme Court because I am female, and he has said so himself many times. The president knows exactly what a woman is. If he didn't know, he wouldn't have picked me, obviously. So please, Senator Blackburn, do not waste my time. With all respect, that is an incredibly stupid question. Imagine if she said that. What an answer that would have been. Do you know a single person wouldn't have cheered? We would have. Honesty is a wonderful thing to watch, no matter where it comes from. But that is not what Ketanji Jackson said. Here was her actual answer.
Can you provide a definition for the word woman?
Can I provide a definition?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
I can't.
You can't?
Not in this context. So I'm not a biologist.
I'm not a biologist. You following this? So only a biologist is allowed to tell you what a woman is. And Ketanji Jackson, incredibly impressive as they tell us she is not, she just reminded us, a biologist. Not that it would make any difference if she were a biologist, because no one in the Democratic Party cares what biologists think about biological sex. Biologists have been banned, along with the lady who writes Harry Potter novels. In 2022, the power of science and literature crumble in the face of the trans lobby. So actually, Ketanji Jackson's academic credentials are not, strictly speaking, all that relevant here. But still, pause for a second and marinate in the awe-inspiring stupidity of her answer. What's a woman? I don't know. I'm not a biologist. Oh, we see how this works. Hey, Ketanji Jackson, is it raining? I don't know. I'm not a meteorologist. How would you respond to someone who said something like that? You'd probably give up and find someone else to talk to. That person was not capable of conversation. So last night we said we wanted to see Ketanji Jackson's LSAT scores, but that's no longer necessary. We can say with certainty she is clearly a sub-genius and probably shouldn't be on the Supreme Court. What's a woman? Definitely the most revealing question ever asked in a Senate confirmation hearing. And one of the many things it reveals is how utterly the Democratic Party as an institution has changed in just 4 years. It's a mile marker that tells us the evolution of the party. So during the last Supreme Court nomination, you'll remember, we were commanded to believe that all women must be believed regardless of whether or not they were telling the truth. They're women. Therefore, in the name of social justice, you must accept whatever they say at face value. A woman's word is like a sworn affidavit. You can take it to the bank. Here's Kamala Harris to explain.
Let's speak truth about what we've all been talking about the last few days and again this evening, which is that Supreme Court process. Let's speak the truth. It was a sham. And a disgrace. Let's speak the truth that it was a denial of justice for the women of this country.
How amusing is it to see Kamala Harris say, let's speak the truth. Throw a beer can at the TV if you agree. So to recap, in 2019, it was, quote, a sham and a disgrace to doubt a woman's word because by the virtue of their biology, women did not lie. That's what it was to be a woman, utterly truthful all the time. Joe Biden agreed with this. Women were very different from men. Inherently, he told us so. And that's why you weren't allowed to hit them. Watch.
We, in fact, have to fundamentally change the culture of how women are treated. No man has a right to raise a hand to a woman in anger other than in self-defense, and that's rarely ever occurs. And so we have to just change the culture, period, and keep punching at it and punching at it and punching at it.
All right, so we mocked him. Keep punching at it. Domestic abuse, that is. We made fun of him, but he was onto something. Actually, what he said was entirely true. Ask yourself, two men get in a bar fight, one of them punches the other in the face. What's your response to that? Come on, guys, take it outside. A man and a woman get in a bar fight, the man punches the woman in the face. What's your response to that? Well, if you're a normal human being, you're horrified. Punching a woman in the face is not just a felony, though it is a moral crime. Decent people don't punch women in the face. Period. A man's best instinct is to protect women. That's nothing to be ashamed of. It makes a civilization civilized. That's why we don't send expectant mothers into battle. Got that, you degraded freaks? Pregnant flight suits are an attempt to make us deny our most basic instinct, an instinct that we should not be ashamed of. Joe Biden had this instinct. He noted it. He was absolutely right. Why was he right? Because men and women are not the same. We're not saying one is morally better than the other. They're morally equal, but they're different on the deepest levels, beginning with biology. Every person on Earth knows this is true. We are born knowing it, but now they're commanding you to pretend otherwise, to deny nature and suppress your most basic and valuable instincts. They're telling you you have no right to be more upset when a woman is injured, or when a woman gets her ear bitten off in a bar fight, than when a man does. Are you ready to suppress those instincts? Are you ready to live in a society that won't acknowledge them? What happens to our justice system if we pretend men and women are exactly the same or don't exist? Ketanji Jackson's claim that we can't say who's a man and who's a woman will transform the way we administer justice, starting with our vast regime of anti-discrimination law. If we can't say for certain who's a woman, how are we going to enforce Joe Biden's famous Violence Against Women Act? Why do we have such an act? Who would care? How can we set aside a huge percentage of federal contracts for women-owned companies if we don't know what a woman is? Oh, I guess that scam's going to have to end tomorrow because it no longer makes any sense. And by the way, how is sexism even a meaningful category in a world in which sex has no meaning? Well, it's not. Why have Title IX, which bans sex discrimination in schools? If we don't have biological sex, how can we have discrimination on the basis of biological sex? Thinking this through? The Trump administration thought it through. Actually, they saw this coming. We should tell you that. The Trump White House tried to preserve Title IX by arguing that the concept of sex as defined in that law derives from biology, not from how you're feeling about your personal identity on any particular day. That's the case they made. In response to that, they were denounced as right-wing lunatics. The ACLU declared that, quote, the Trump administration is trying to erase trans people. Really? Maybe it was bigger than that. Now, the Biden administration is in charge of everything, and in less than a year, the worst, most fervid predictions have come entirely true. Female athletes are losing NCAA championships to men dressing up as women in order to cheat their way to victory. Every person in America sees this happening. Very few are brave enough to say a word about it. But here's one of them. This is a woman who happened to be watching an NCAA swimming championship in which a male swimmer going by the name of Leah Thomas dominated every woman in the pool.
I'm a woman. That is not a woman. Can I ask you a question? That is not a woman.
Can I ask you a question?
Do I vote for me?
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go on, then ask me a question.
Are you a male?
Oh, my God. Don't be ridiculous. No, I'm not a vet, but I know what a dog is.
We'd love to have her on. I'm not a vet, but I know what a dog is. Yes, you do. We all do. Even Ketanji Jackson knows. She's had a few children of her own. She probably learned exactly how the process works. The point of the trans movement isn't to convince anyone that biology isn't real. They're not even trying. That's an impossible case to make. You would sound ridiculous if you tried to articulate that, much less explain it. The point of this exercise is very different. The point is to make the rest of us repeat a lie, to say something we know perfectly well is not true. Yes, Leah Thomas is a proud, beautiful woman who won the swim meet because she practiced harder than the other girls. Leah Thomas deserved to win. Her victory wasn't cheating. And no, I don't notice her bulging swimsuit. I have no idea what you're talking about. That's what they demand you say. Not because they care about Leah Thomas or any other trans person. They could care less. Making you pretend to believe something you don't, that's the point. Because if they can make you pretend to believe something you know is untrue, they've won. They control your brain. So this isn't about trans people. It's about all of us, and the stakes are very high. And that's why the censorship is so intense. Have you noticed? Our national conversation about transgenderism is completely defined by censorship, by making you shut up. Not allowing you to notice the obvious is why they're doing it. There's no attempt to persuade you. There's no fact-based argument. You can't respond, oh, so men can become women just by wishing it so? Tell us how that works. Can I stop male pattern baldness the same way? Can I grow 6 inches? Please explain how this remarkable new power the trans community has discovered might apply to me. Can I do it too? The power of positive thinking. Well, that's a fair question. They'll never answer it. They'll just make you be quiet. Their first move always is censorship, and their second move inevitably is punishment. We learned that again last night when we were suspended from Twitter. Quote, we have determined that this account violated the Twitter rules, specifically for violating our rules against hateful conduct, Twitter wrote to us. The only way out of Twitter jail was to delete our tweet.
to pretend we never said it, to cleanse America's conscience by just whiting out the past. What was our crime, by the way? Well, we dared to highlight two accounts that Twitter has banned from Charlie Kirk and the Babylon Bee. There was nothing hateful about either one. We'd say look them up, but you can't because they're gone now. But both merely noted that biological sex is fixed at birth. This has been universally acknowledged by Homo sapiens for at least 300,000 years. So it was a factual statement. But on Twitter, as in our public life, truth is no defense. Twitter is now run by a man called Parag Agrawal, who has said plainly he does not believe in free speech. Agrawal came to this country as an adult to get a degree from Stanford. Now Agrawal controls the single most important forum for America's political conversation. That is a big and important job. It's not just a public company. It's much more than that. It's a kind of public trust that allows this democracy to function. So you would think you'd want a guy like that in a position like that to have some respect for his adopted country's core institutions, beginning with and primarily the First Amendment. But Agrawal has no respect for our First Amendment or our Constitution. He explained that openly in a 2020 speech. Watch.
Our role is not to be bound by the First Amendment, but our role is to serve a healthy public conversation. And our moves are reflective of things that we believe lead to a healthier public conversation. The kinds of things that we do to what about this is to focus less on thinking about free speech, but thinking about how the times have changed. One of the changes today that we see is speech is easy on the internet. Most people can speak. Where our role is particularly emphasized is who can be heard.
Oh, so the new standard isn't your right as a citizen to say what you believe is true. The new standard is achieving something called healthy public conversation. By the way, this is not one man's opinion. You grew up in a country where people were free to say what they wanted. But now that political speech, in fact, all speech is disseminated to other citizens via social media, this is the guy who actually controls what you're allowed to think. So what is healthy public conversation? What does that mean exactly? We're interested. So we texted Parag Agrawal very first thing this morning, and then we emailed his office, and then him personally, all to find out. Agrawal was too cowardly to respond to us. So we're going to have to assume that a healthy public conversation is whatever Parag Agrawal wants it to be. He decides the meaning. In other words, a single man who has total and undisguised contempt for America's most basic values gets to decide what Americans are allowed to talk about. Parag Agrawal doesn't think you should know about Hunter Biden's laptop. That's unhealthy. So he censors the story. You don't get to see it. He doesn't think you should be allowed to discuss basic biology in public. We're erasing all science because it's unhealthy. So now you're not allowed to talk about it. In fact, you're banned, silenced, censored. We can't control Parag Agrawal, but we can ask, how do you feel about this new standard? Not so long ago, this was a free country. Now Parag Agrawal and nine other billionaires whose names you might not even know, who certainly were not elected to anything, get to determine the limits of your conversations. Are we okay with this? What happened to all the liberals and the self-described civil libertarians we used to have in America? They don't seem to be fighting the power anymore. They seem to have joined it. How about Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and everyone else who's constantly lecturing the serfs about democracy? Is this the kind of democracy they're talking about? A democracy in which a tiny sliver of very rich people control everything, including your mind? Doesn't sound like democracy. It sounds suspiciously like oligarchy, don't you think? They can let us know. All those people are welcome on this show anytime, including and very much including you, Parag Agrawal. We promise a healthy public conversation.
We're going to finish the show with the beginning, the first 10 minutes of David Icke. He's talking about psychopaths and everything. Then we're going to put up and embed his total speech on this subject. But anyway, look out for that. But here we go with David Icke, and he's really insightful, has a lot of good, interesting, and very, very cogent opinion and things to say. So here we go with David Icke.
Hello, and welcome to the DavidIcke.connect videocast. Well, I read this week that about 1% of the human population is a psychopath. And I started laughing till the tears were pouring down my face and my belly hurt. I've read other articles that have put the figure at as much as 4%, but that's still a joke. The number of psychopaths in the human population is massively greater than that. And among the ruling class, it's absolutely colossal. And so when you look at the current situation in Ukraine and other horrific situations around the world and through history, what you're looking at is psychopaths fighting psychopaths. Because psychopaths rule the world and psychopathic morons administer it for them. That's the dynamic, with the people as the fall guys for the psychopaths. And with the psychopathic mentality comes the narcissistic mentality. The two are basically expressions of each other in so many ways. And there is an official way of deciding if someone's a psychopath. And it's called the hair test. It's nothing to do with this. It's to do with a man called Robert D. Hare, a Canadian forensic psychologist at the University of British Columbia, specializing in criminal psychology. He developed the Hare psychopathy checklist used to assess cases of psychopathy. He advises the FBI's Child Abduction and Serial Murder Investigative Resources Center and consults for various British and North American prison services. So what Hare did was compile this list of traits that decide if you're a psychopath or not. See if you recognize any of them in terms of those who are making decisions that affect the lives of the global population. Glibness, superficial charm. I'm seeing this picture in my mind of Tony Blair. Grandiose sense of self-worth. Well, all of them. Pathological lying. Are you kidding? Cunning, manipulative. Lack of remorse or guilt. Callous, lack of empathy. Failure to accept responsibility for their own actions. They are psychopathic traits. And they relate to all these people in positions of power around the world. Also, they have a parasitic lifestyle. And what are these people doing? They're living off the population and the efforts and the labor of the population. Then there's the narcissistic personality, which again fits these people. Grandiose sense of self-importance. A lot of these traits cross-reference. Preoccupation with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty. Belief that he or she is special and unique and can only be understood by or should associate with other special or high status people or institutions. This is the cult and the way it operates, where they all congregate together in this secret society network. A need for excessive admiration. They demand that others admire their appearance, accomplishments, skills, or existence. The admiration of others is what feeds the narcissist. Sense of entitlement. Narcissists may believe that success takes hard work, but only for others, not them. They totally believe that they deserve the best tickets, the top score, the highest or nicest room, and the best seat in the house. Narcissists see other people as tools. Their lack of self-awareness is paralleled by a lack of awareness that others exist as individuals with feelings, needs, and desires. I mean, just look at it. As each new trait is added, the number of people, like I say, not least in the ruling classes, that this applies to in the ruling classes, almost all of them. Lack of empathy. This is the key, not just to narcissism, it's the key to psychopathy. This is the cold inability to accurately recognize how other people feel. And if you can't put yourself in the feelings of those you affect, you have no emotional consequence for whatever you do to them. And this is why the psychopathic, narcissistic mentality has treated the human population as it has throughout the COVID era and right to now with the massive economic dismantling and unraveling that's going on. Because what happens to the population, these people couldn't care less about, they have no capacity to feel it. And so when people say, they'd never do that, no, you'd never do that, they would love it. So talking of empathy or lack of it, this speaks to the narcissist's lack of emotional awareness or depth. It is not always that narcissists don't care about another's feelings. It's just that they're unaware that others might even have any feelings. Another trait, the false belief that everyone else is envious of them. That's how they keep their egos intact. Because these are really insecure people. That's why they need their ego constantly massaged. Demonstration of arrogant and haughty behaviors or attitudes. Arrogance and conceit are traits that are often noticed first in narcissists, also psychopaths. This is evidenced by disrespect for the positions or rights of others and the narcissist's willingness to demand and expect that others bend to their will. So here in this list of traits of psychopaths and narcissists, you have the very traits that we have allowed to take control of our lives. So when you look at what's happening now in Ukraine, Russia, what's happened throughout history, what you're looking at is, like I say, psychopaths fighting psychopaths. So Putin is a psychopath. Okay, no problem. You won't get pushback on that from me. But leading the Ukraine government is someone called Volodymyr Zelensky, who is portrayed as a hero and a defender of freedom and democracy. Zelensky's a psychopath, a narcissist. Deeply, deeply corrupt, controlled by the cult, the United States, by the oligarchs that run his country.